Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, if you've been wondering what's been going on with Bar Veloce in Narrowsburg, why the lights are still off and the doors are still locked, you're not alone. The bar's owner tried to get that shutdown reversed, but the town's zoning board says their hands are tied. We'll talk with Liam Mayo from the River Reporter about what that means for the business, neighbors, and the community. Zoran Mamdani is the mayor-elect of New York City, but his real fight starts in Albany. Jason Dole sat down with New York Focus reporters Chris Bragg and Sam Mellons to break down what the new mayor will face as he navigates lawmakers, lobbyists, and Governor Hochul. What do Elise Stefanik's constituents in her upstate New York district think about her run for governor? We'll find out. And students across Sullivan County are planting, harvesting, and learning life lessons in their own edible school gardens. And we'll find out why a local artist has two chairs floating over Manhattan. After the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson is calling for House members to return to review a government funding measure. The Senate passed the stopgap measure yesterday to end the federal government shutdown. The House could vote on it as early as tomorrow. NPR's Sam Greenglass explains some of what's in the measure.
Some of this is very similar to what the Senate has been voting on for weeks now, a temporary funding measure to fund the government for just a few weeks, in this case, through January 30th. But this time, lawmakers also included three bipartisan annual appropriations bills that cover specific agencies like the Department of Agriculture and the FDA. So instead of a short-term extension, those areas will be funded now through next September.
NPR's Sam Greenglass reporting. When the government shutdown does come to an end, the effect on air travel is expected to last much longer. NPR's Windsor Johnston reports experts say the nation's aviation system won't bounce back overnight.
Transportation officials say it won't be as simple as flipping a switch. Thousands of FAA workers still have to clear weeks of inspections and safety backlogs before things run smoothly again. The longer the shutdown drags on, the more the work piles up, forcing airlines to cancel or delay flights even after funding is restored. And it's not just passengers feeling the impact. Cargo carriers like FedEx, UPS, and Amazon are warning of delays during the busiest shopping season of the year. Industry analysts say once freight piles up, it can take weeks to untangle supply chains, leaving retailers and consumers feeling the strain. Windsor Johnston, NPR News, Washington.
The bond market is closed today for the Veterans Day holiday. The stock market is open, however, and as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, trading is mixed. The Dow Jones Industrials are up more than 100 points.
Stock in the chip-making giant NVIDIA opened lower after news that SoftBank sold its stake in the company for about $5.8 billion. Some investors worry the artificial intelligence boom that's propelled NVIDIA to stratospheric heights could be overblown. Analysts say consumers in China are hunting for bargains rather than splurging on big-ticket items during this year's Singles Day promotion. The event is seen as a gauge of consumer sentiment in China. And Warren Buffett won't be writing his annual letter to shareholders once he steps down as Berkshire Hathaway CEO later this year. He promised to keep sending a Thanksgiving message, though, including this year's advice, not to beat yourself up over mistakes, but to learn from them and move on. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On this Veterans Day, President Trump is scheduled to visit Arlington National Cemetery later this morning. During his official observance of the day, he will lay a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier. The president will also deliver remarks. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Gen Z and millennial Americans are expected to make up more than half of the electorate in the next presidential election. But as NPR's Elena Moore reports, many feel unseen by elected leaders, especially as they try to keep up with rising costs.
25-year-old Daisy Lupa recently moved back in with her parents in Michigan after struggling to get a job post-graduation. She's always backed Democrats, but says her patience with leaders is running thin.
I hear my grandparents and people of the older generation talking about America being the greatest country in the world. And that's just not what I see. And I see all of these ways that our government is failing its citizens.
A recent report from the nonpartisan research organization Circle found that just 16% of voters under 30 believe democracy is working for them. Elena Moore, NPR News.
The White House is appealing a judge's order to immediately provide American Sign Language interpreters at press briefings given by President Trump or Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt. White House attorneys say it may not always work logistically because the government's ASL vendor agreement requires 24-hour notice for services. The National Association of the Deaf told the court yesterday it is skeptical about that explanation. The group is suing the Trump administration. A frigid mass of cold air continues to blanket the eastern two-thirds of the country. Parts of the South are getting record low temperatures and freeze and frost warnings. A winter storm is now pulling away from the Great Lakes region. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us this Veterans Day, and you can find a list of Sullivan County veteran ceremonies at our website, wjffradio.org. We're taking a closer look now at a story that's stirring up big questions in a small town, Bar Veloce, the upscale Narrowsburg spot shuttered in late August over fire and building code issues, has lost its first attempt to challenge that shutdown. The Tustin Zoning Board of Appeals rejected the bar's owner's appeal this week, saying the issue is a state matter, not theirs. What does it mean for the business and its neighbors and the future of the community? We're joined now by River reporter and journalist Liam Mayo, who's been following this case closely. Liam, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So for listeners who haven't been following it closely, can you summarize why Bar Veloce in Narrowsburg was closed in August?
Yeah. So in August, the town, or specifically on August 28th, the town's code enforcement officer, Jim Crowley, revoked the building's certificate of occupancy, the document that is required for a building to legally have people in it and be open. And the rescission notice reads, in part, you cannot open this eating and drinking establishment known as Bar Veloce until fire and building code issues are addressed, as per Section 107, Unsafe Structures and Equipment of the New York State Property Maintenance Code. The exact sort of what was wrong with the building remains a little bit unclear. However, the town just earlier that week had received notice that a key engineering document for the building's second-story rooftop deck had been a forgery. The engineer who had purportedly written that report wrote the town earlier that week saying, hey, I didn't write this report. Someone else used my signature. The project team behind Bar Veloce has said that they fell victim to an internet scam, which was the reason for that report. That was sort of the reason. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, so then that's sort of what happened there. And then the Bar Veloce's owner appealed this closure to the town of Tustin Zoning Board of Appeals, saying that the town's code enforcer had acted arbitrarily in closing the business, and they just held a meeting last night, which you attended. So what did the ZBA do?
Yeah, so a large part of what Bar Veloce was arguing was that that notice was unclear, vague. The code enforcer didn't have enough reason to close the business. They said that the code enforcer didn't conduct any in-person inspections of the business before issuing that closure, and said that you'd have to inspect a business like that in order to prove that it's unsafe and in need of closure. There was a quote from the business's lawyer saying his basis for revoking the CBO was this claim that there was imminent danger to the premises. It's beyond my understanding how he could have made that determination without having conducted an inspection of the premises. What the ZBA said was, you can make that argument, but you can't make that argument to us. You need to make it to New York State. Because the violations cited in that report, or the not the report, the notice of closure, because those were issues with the New York State Fire and Building Code, not town of Tustin zoning issues, there's not really a lot the Town of Tustin Zoning Board can do about it. Like, if the code enforcer had issued a notice based on violation of a Town of Tustin zoning law, that's a place where the ZBA could have stepped in. But because it was building code related, that appeal has to go to New York State.
And then what did Barveloce's owner, the attorney for Frederick Tuomi, who was the owner there, say about this determination from the zoning board?
Yeah, they weren't thrilled about it, I would say. They argued the point a little bit back and forth about whether the ZBA had jurisdiction or not. But I spoke with him after the meeting, and he said that, like, this was their first stop of appeal. However, they are going to keep fighting this and will take it to court if necessary. So the next steps for this business, I think, will involve, or it seems like it will involve, them continuing to make this case against the revocation of the certificate of occupancy to other authorities, whether that's the courts or New York State or whomever. However, I think a distinction that I see is all of that with the certificate of occupancy would only allow, if I'm understanding correctly, the bar to reopen its first floor, which has been open in the past. The bar has never really had all of its permits in order for the rooftop deck. And after the revelation of that forged document, the planning board, as a separate action, rescinded the permit it had recently granted for that rooftop deck. So that would be a completely different, like, thing where the business would have to go back before the planning board and work on getting its permits in order for that rooftop deck if it wanted to have that entire space open. So that would be a separate thing from the business appealing this certificate of occupancy revocation.
And I mentioned in the introduction that, you know, what does this mean for the community? And it's not just a local business being closed for an extended period of time, but this has really involved business owners and community members sort of pitted against each other, I guess.
Yeah, this business has been in and out of the courts and in and out of sort of planning disputes for years, ever since, I think, even before it was opened. There's a neighboring business, the Knaresburg Union, across the street that has feuded with Barveloce for that entire period of time and has sort of filed a lot of complaints against it and filed a lot of actions against it. And a lot of that has gotten bogged down in technicalities, like jurisdictional issues and timings of disputes and that kind of thing. But I think at the heart, where Knaresburg Union is coming from is a
and those are the neighboring parking. Those are the neighboring business owners who first filed some legal action at the planning board in early August.
Yes, the neighboring business Knaresburg Union has claimed from the beginning that Barveloce just isn't in the right spot, that it doesn't have enough parking on its location, and that customers from that business will then go across the street and park in the Knaresburg Union's parking, harming their business. And they've also claimed that a lot of things have been done improperly with how Barveloce has opened and how it has operated over the years. And again, a lot of that has gotten bogged down in technicalities, but then there's other stuff like the forged engineering report that's much less technical and much sort of more real. But what the Barveloce is kind of arguing and why this is a little bit split the community is that there needs to be a certain leeway in the application of town laws. There's in the sort of complaint before the planning board, they quoted a couple of times the town's code enforcement officer has said, if he strictly enforced every regulation in the book, everyone would be in violation of property maintenance, everyone, including myself, essentially arguing that, like, it's a small town. We're all sort of trying to work together to encourage business and to open up. And we don't want to get bogged down in technicalities. We want to support this business opening. So it's not just, like, issues with one particular business, it's a little bit of a deeper symptom of differing opinions on how to enforce and regulate development in a fairly restricted area.
Mm. It really seems to be, you know, splitting the town a little bit. But did you speak to Frederick Tuomi, the Bar Veloce owner, yesterday at the meeting? And what did he tell you?
Yeah, I spoke with him very briefly. He mostly directed me to his attorney, but I asked about the Origin Engineering report and just sort of where that was going. And he said that that was still under investigation and that they were going to get to the bottom of it.
And as you mentioned, it looks like, according to the attorney for Tuomi, they will continue to pursue this, which would then mean, given the ZBA's ruling, going to the state level.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see whether they try and appeal it. I believe the New York State Department of State would be the correct, like, appellate authority, but I'm not 100% certain on that. Like, whichever department of state government regulates building code, or whether the business goes directly to the courts, which has happened previously. This business has appeared in pretty much an A to Z list of the regulatory and appellate authorities of New York State. So it'll be interesting to see where next this case pops up.
Yeah, given the publicity, I guess, this particular business has received, how was the meeting last night? Were there more people than normal at a zoning board meeting on a Monday night?
Maybe a couple more, but it was fairly quiet. Yeah.
All right. The River Reporter's Liam Mayo covering this story. You can read his reporting on this and other stories online at theriverreporter.com. Thank you so much, Liam.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll take a look at New York City's new mayor, Zohran Mamdani, as he prepares to take office. His biggest challenges may not be in the city itself. Radio Catskill's Jason Dole talks with New York Focus about Mamdani's upcoming battles in Albany with lawmakers, lobbyists, and Governor Kathy Hochul. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill depends on donations from our listeners, including donations from our listeners' music collections. People donate their music collections to us, we sell them to the next generation of music fans, and that keeps the station on air. Records, CDs, stereo equipment, and more. It comes from the community and goes back to the community, so Radio Catskill can stay on the air for the community. Donate your music collection today. Email feedback at wjffradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio, the hidden side of the U.S. doctor shortage.
In the middle of COVID, I am hearing hospital beds are closed because they don't have staff and personnel.
But which is better, a bad doctor or no doctor at all?
Low-quality doctors were actually harming people.
The doctor won't see you now. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The biggest news in New York politics for the past week was the victory of New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani. While many in the national news wonder what this means for the Democratic Party, and others wonder how Mamdani will run the city, our partners at New York Focus are looking ahead to what Mamdani will encounter as he works with Albany, its lawmakers, its lobbyists, and Governor Kathy Hochul. Yesterday, Radio Catskill's Jason Dole spoke with Chris Bragg, Albany Bureau Chief at New York Focus, and Sam Mellence, Senior Reporter, about their recent article, Zohran Mamdani's Next Big Battle is in Albany. Jason started by asking if the experience of any recent mayors of New York may be what Mamdani can expect from Albany.
Probably the most obvious comparison is Bill de Blasio, who won election in 2013, also a progressive. He ran on hiking income taxes and then using it to fund pre-kindergarten. Basically, that caused a big fight with Andrew Cuomo. So we'll have to see if that kind of relationship develops with Governor Hochul and how hard Mamdani pushes for an income tax hike, or if he's willing to accept something that does not include an income tax hike but may you know, without that money, incorporate some of what he wants. So I think that's, you know, the big question is if he's going to be more pragmatic than de Blasio was in terms of compromising, or if he's not going to be, you know, which would definitely disappoint some of his allies.
You know, your subheading says it all. Now he needs to convince Albany politicians. This is after he convinced New York City voters. So what is the road ahead of him in Albany? What does that look like?
Well, you know, it looks like the state is going to have a multi-billion dollar budget deficit because of Trump administration cuts. So that's going to be happening at the same time that Mamdani is seeking these very expensive plans that he wants to push through. So the question is, you know, will the legislature and the governor agree to raise income taxes? That's something that Governor Hochul has really been resisting since she took office. So we'll see if an election year if there's any movement on that. I did speak to the head of the Working Families Party, influential third party that has its own ballot line. The Working Families Party is going to look at whether she raises income taxes if she makes cuts to various programs in her budget, and is definitely open to supporting a challenger to Hochul. So that will be one interesting dynamic to look at in an election year.
That's significant because many Democratic candidates on the ballot in New York State often do get the support of the Working Families Party. They're telling you that they're going to be watching the governor, and that's still an open question if she gets that endorsement.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be very difficult for anybody to win a primary against an incumbent governor. That hasn't happened in a long, long time. I think if in the general election, the Working Families Party generally, you know, will back the Democrat, including Hochul, against a Republican. So I don't think that's the question necessarily. But if Hochul has to spend money on a primary challenger, like against her former lieutenant governor from your area, Antonio Delgado, that could at least, you know, sap some time and resources away from what's probably a tougher general election that the governor has.
Chris, I do want to circle back to what you're saying there about the governor not wanting to raise taxes. But while you're mentioning the Working Families Party, it kind of made headlines that Mamdani voted in the mayoral race on the Working Families Party line. Is this getting that party more attention? Is their star a bit more on the rise since this election?
Yeah, maybe so. They've been around for a long time as a, you know, a political force. I think the really early adopters of Mamdani were the Democratic Socialists of America. And that's really kind of the new force, I think. The Working Families Party, I believe, did rank him first during the primary, but maybe came to the party a little bit later than the DSA did. So I would say if there's, you know, one kind of new kid on the block that's really rising, it would be the DSA of anyone.
Right. So is there any place or any group or any lawmakers with whom Mamdani is likely to get some traction and get some support in Albany?
I think he has a lot of support from certain lawmakers and certain groups. He was endorsed, especially after he won the primary, by a lot of different lawmakers in the Democratic caucus. I mean, Governor Hochul herself, but also top Democrats in both the Senate and the Assembly. He was endorsed by a lot of labor unions, you know, teachers, nurses, hotel workers who have significant sway in Albany. But there's also significant forces that will be pushing against him, like you know, a lot of businesses that don't want to see the corporate tax go up and their lobby groups. So it's going to be sort of an unstoppable force, immovable object kind of dynamic going on there, I think.
You have a great quote in here from a longtime Albany lobbyist, Evan Stavisky, saying, quote, he's already demonstrating a desire to work with non-traditional allies and deal with the actual political dynamics as they exist, end quote. Can you talk to me about that observation and what that means?
Yeah, so, what, you know, Stavisky was getting into the fact that, you know, Hochul has been pretty public that she doesn't want to raise income taxes, and Mamdani hasn't pushed back on that in the way that de Blasio did against Cuomo. De Blasio, even after Cuomo agreed to fund de Blasio's pre-kindergarten plan without raising taxes, and give basically de Blasio what he wanted, except for the tax hike. De Blasio continued to fight that plan. Mamdani so far hasn't gone down that route. We'll see what happens when, you know, the rubber hits the road next year in terms of paying for these things. But so far he hasn't, you know, he hasn't criticized Governor Hochul about that tax issue. So we'll just have to see how that plays out.
Any indication as to what their working relationship is going to be, Hochul and Mamdani?
I think so far they have both really taken pains to portray themselves as having a friendly relationship. You know, the governor spoke at Mamdani's big rally in Forest Hills, Queens, to get out the vote. And he came on stage with her and he held their hands up together above their heads, you know, the in the sign of partnership. And they've both avoided criticizing each other, certainly personally, but also any sort of really intense political disagreement as well. I think that's easier to maintain now and will be, as Chris was saying, will be harder to maintain once they actually start trying to hash out their differences. But I think they're both trying to go into that with the hand of friendship extended.
There's politics involved at every level here, and we're talking about how New York City relates to Albany, what that working relationship is like. There's always a politics of just what's happening in the moment, but then there's also the political implications in what will be an election year for the governor in 2026. That's kind of hanging over everything. Since we got the news on election night that Mamdani won the election in New York City, we also got the news that, as was suspected for a while, at least Stefanik is actually going to be running for governor. She threw her hat in the ring. Do any of those developments since election night change the political dynamic for the governor?
Elise Stefanik is an interesting case because she definitely has a strong following. She can definitely raise funds. I think she can be a compelling speaker. So all that sort of points in her favor. But also she's very closely allied herself to President Trump, which in New York is generally not hugely popular. So I think that will be an obstacle to her as she tries to mount a serious challenge to Governor Hochul. At the same time, I think even the threat of that challenge will make Hochul not want to appear too far left, too radical. But then just one more thing, which is to win in New York, a Democratic governor needs heavy turnout from New York City. So she's going to want to seem like she's delivering for New York City, where the majority of voters supported Zohran Mamdani.
When I look at the race for mayor in New York City, everybody's saying, what does this mean for the Democratic Party? And I was wondering, will at the national level, will the Democratic Party change to adopt his strategy if it finds it to be a winning strategy? That question I'm still asking myself. I'm still looking at the Democratic Party nationally. But in New York State, just because they need to have this working relationship between the city and Albany, are we already starting to see an answer to that question, at least at the state level?
I can give it a shot. I think Mamdani's campaign was really centered on the issue of affordability, and all of his signature proposals were framed as ways to address the high and increasing cost of living in New York City. And that's definitely been something that Governor Hochul has focused on as well, you know, with initiatives like her inflation rebate checks, which were somewhat controversial. So I think a lot of the analysis since the election has focused on affordability as a salient theme and one that we're likely to see emphasized heading into a major election year.
Chris, is there anything that you've been noticing, anything that you've heard or seen in the news cycle since you put this story out following Election Day last week? Anything that impacts what you guys are writing about here that you've noticed?
Yeah, well, you know, as occurs every year, the Albany political class and New York City political class went down to the SOMOS conference in Puerto Rico over the weekend. You know, there's always a lot of wheeling and dealing related to the New York City Council speaker race and what's happening during the legislative session. And Governor Hochul did make a couple notable comments. She continued to say that she was going to work with Mamdani related to child care, which seems to be the most likely thing to pass. But she really threw cold water, it seemed, on the idea of a free bus plan that was another signature issue for Mamdani. So already, now that the election's over, she's, kind of, it almost seemed like she was taking a little bit less positive tone towards his agenda. She also got heckled by more people on the left that were protesting her, telling her to tax the rich. And she basically said, the more that you do this, the less likely I am to do what you want. So an interesting statement for a politician to make. And, more developments keep happening.
Wait, so. Was that the governor talking to hecklers in real time, talking to protesters in real time?
Yeah, I would have to pull up the exact quote. But yeah, she said, basically, you know, I hear you. And, the more you do this, the less likely I am to do what you want to do. Sam mentioned that rally in Forest Hills, the same thing happened where Hochul got on stage and basically got heckled by people saying tax the rich. This is something that she's going to face with the new mayor pressing for that. And we'll see if the mayor joins in or if he continues to, play nice with the governor.
Sam, mm-hmm. Any final thoughts that you want to share with folks on this whole area of reporting? Yeah.
I think we covered it. I guess one thing I would say is we've seen a little bit about who Mamdani is putting in his administration and his transition team. And there has been a heavy focus on veterans of city government, veterans of the major nonprofits in the city, people with deep experience in governance and executive management. And so I think in that way, what we're seeing suggests a continuation of a lot of things that have been happening in the administration of New York City rather than a radical departure. But we will have to see how it really shakes out when we hit January 1st, which is Inauguration Day.
All right. Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to go over this with us, and I wish you all the best.
My pleasure, Jason.
Chris Bragg, Albany Bureau Chief, and Sam Mellons, Senior Reporter at New York Focus, in conversation with our own Jason Dole. Their work is up now at nysfocus.com. A quick break for us, and when we come back, Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is leaving Washington behind and setting her sights on Albany. The North Country Republican wants to unseat Governor Hochul, but Adirondack voters aren't sold on either candidate. We'll get the pulse of the region next. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill's big annual music sale returns November 29th, the Saturday after Thanksgiving. With vinyl records, cassettes, CDs, stereo equipment, musical instruments, and more, we're still accepting donations. If you're a collector who can part with any high-quality or rare vinyl, we'd love to hear from you. Email feedback@wjffradio.org or just come to the big music sale, 10 to 3, November 29th at the Liberty Mall.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Congresswoman Elise Stefanik has set her sights on Albany after more than a decade in D.C. The Republican from the North Country announced her bid for New York's top job last week. She's aiming to unseat Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, but what do her constituents think? The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell spoke with voters in the Adirondacks who find flaws in both candidates.
Elise Stefanik was first elected to represent the North Country in Congress in 2014. Back then, she was seen as a moderate and pledged to be a fresh voice in Washington. On the morning Stefanik announced her bid for governor, I meet Zebulon Edwards at a gas station in Raybrook. He's a Democrat and says he appreciated how Stefanik governed in those early years.
I would say probably her first, like, 3-4 years was great. I actually really liked her. And then she kind of took a turn, and it seems like things have gone in a different direction with her, and I don't support that anymore.
Edwards is referring to Stefanik's hard shift to the right and her unwavering loyalty to President Donald Trump. When it comes to Governor Kathy Hochul, Edwards says his opinions are mixed.
I would like to see somebody else run for governor.
As a Democrat or Republican?
Either one. I don't really have a preference for either party right now. I just want to see something fresh, something new.
Hochul has struggled to build support in rural upstate regions like the North Country. She lost every county here in 2022. The widest margin was in Lewis County, where she earned less than 18% of the vote. Dan Olson is a school bus driver from Saranac Lake. He's a registered Republican and is critical of some of Hochul's mandates, like her push for electric school buses and all-electric home appliances.
It seems like she likes to ban a lot of things, like ban gas stoves. You know, all houses have to be electric by a certain date. And electric heat is really expensive, especially around here.
Olson believes Stefanik understands those issues, and he thinks she'd bring more federal dollars to the state since she's got close ties to Trump. But Olson would also like to see Stefanik stand on her own and put some distance between herself and the president.
I think she really needs to be a more independent thinker. And hopefully, if she does get elected to this new position, hopefully she can kind of de-align herself with the president.
But other Republicans see Stefanik's self-described ultra-MAGA stance as a good thing. James Walker is a registered Republican and lives out near Bloomingdale. I meet him sipping coffee in a gas station. Walker thinks Stefanik's loyalty to Trump will help her in the governor's race.
There's a lot of people in this area that are for Donald Trump. So I don't think that's really going to hurt her chances.
But statewide, Democrats outweigh Republicans by a 2-to-1 margin. A Republican hasn't won the governor's race in New York since 2002. There are also more than 3 million voters unaffiliated with any political party. Walker has voted for Stefanik in every election and is happy she's trying to oust Hochul from the top job.
I think Kathy Hochul is dragging us down. I'm a retired correction officer, and she didn't really do good for the correction officers.
Hochul fired about 2,000 corrections officers after they illegally went on strike and then refused to return to work once the state reached a deal with the union representing COs. Inside a cafe in downtown Saranac Lake, Lisa Meissner and her husband are out for breakfast. They're both Democrats. Meissner is critical of Stefanik's voting record, especially her support for Trump's big tax bill this summer, which will make massive cuts to Medicaid. That program provides health coverage to more than 30% of folks in the North Country.
I mean, we could lose all our hospitals in the North Country because of her actions. So that, I don't think she's serving us.
Meissner says she's not wild about Governor Hochul, but she thinks Stefanik could be really dangerous for New York.
I'm hopeful she has no chance, but we also have to be very mindful and not take it for granted.
The last time Hochul was challenged by a Republican, Lee Zeldin, she won by just a narrow 6-point margin. The latest independent poll released in September had Hochul leading Stefanik by 25 points. New York has long been seen as a solidly blue state, though it saw the biggest swing of Republican voters nationwide in last year's election. In Saranac Lake, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Coming up next, students across Sullivan County are planting, harvesting, and learning life lessons in their very own school gardens. This is Radio Chatsko.
This is Cooper R. Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskills Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Hi, Ira Flato here from Science Friday. We view Sci-Fry as a refreshing break from the daily bombardment of political news. You know, there's lots of important and interesting science and technology out there. Whether it's the deep, dark mysteries of the universe or your deep, dark microbiome, it's all right here. So start your weekends with thought-provoking news on Radio Catskill.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Some kids in Sullivan County are trading screens for soil, and they're kind of loving it. The Catskill Edible Garden Project is turning schoolyards into edible gardens where students plant, harvest, and learn about healthy food, nature, and teamwork. From just 4 gardens in 2012 to 15 this year, the program is growing, and so are the kids' smiles. Today, we talk with Christy Green from Liberty Elementary and Ava Bednar from Sullivan 180 about standout garden moments, the lessons students are learning, and how the community can dig in.
The Catskill Edible Garden Project
was founded in 2012 as a collaboration between Sullivan 180, Catskill Mountain Keeper, and Cornell Cooperative Extension to establish edible gardens, so vegetable, herb, fruit gardens across Sullivan County as gathering and educational spaces for youth.
And how many school or community gardens are thriving right now? What's new this year as well?
Yeah, when we started in 2012, there were four gardens that were built. And this year in 2025, we have 15 gardens in the program. So it's been a really lovely growth and people have really good feedback on the results that they see from the kids. It's just so good for physical health, mental health, social health, just for kids to be outside in the fresh air, connecting to the natural ecosystem, and also encouraged to try new whole vegetables and foods that they might not eat otherwise.
What are some success stories or standout moments from the 2024 season there?
Yeah. So each garden has its own garden coordinator, which is a local person from that site or school that leads that garden's initiatives and activities. And honestly, one of the highlights was going to the Liberty Elementary School garden this past June. And so their wonderful garden coordinator, Christy, had organized a garden day where we had over 200 students come in cycles through different classes to the garden. And just seeing their excitement to get their hands on and the planting and the feedback from them, one of the girls had said that the best part of my life is gardening, which was really sweet just to see the impact on how that can be a restorative space for students.
And you're not just saying this was a standout moment because Christy is sitting next to you.
Nope, I would say it anyway.
Thanks, Ava.
Christy, tell us about, what drew you to becoming a school garden coordinator? Was there a particular moment that made you say, I want to do this?
Actually, I was approached many years ago about being the garden coordinator. I love being outside. I love working with my hands, and I thought it'd be a great opportunity to bring students into that as well. Over the years, our garden has evolved into the space that it is today, and it will continue to change every year, but I just love to be outside, and it's rewarding to be part of something that is so impactful for our school.
How do the students interact with the garden? Is there a particular thing that excites them most when they're out there?
So there's many things to do in the garden, and our garden provides, obviously, academic enrichment through hands-on and learning. Students get an opportunity to understand where food comes from, and it encourages healthier eating habits, which is part of our wellness policy. Having access to the garden helps students gain a deeper appreciation for nature and thinking about conservation and food waste. Through working in the garden, students learn to collaborate, share, take responsibility for the outcomes, and it's just really a great place to be. Now, they do love to play tic-tac-toe with our wood stones and our rocks. They love to be able to use the scale and weigh things. They love to just dig, sit by the stream, play in the sand. There's just a lot of other fun things, but they always have to work first, then they play.
Then they get to play.
Yes.
How do they make use of the produce that you've grown, and what have you grown?
So we have actually been able to harvest tomatoes, beans, potatoes, lettuce, kale, many things, some herbs as well. And often the students get to enjoy their harvest after a hard day's work, but we also are able to donate some of our harvest to the elementary kitchen, which is used in our salad bar as well as other dishes.
Why do you think having a school garden is transformative for students? What changes have you seen in them?
I see them just being so exciting about just being outside and understanding that food grows and what they can do with it and interacting with their peers. It's just really rewarding.
Is there a particular student experience that you could share that's something that got somebody really excited or a moment that stuck with you about the gardening experience?
It's really every time they discover something or they make a connection, they go and they find something and they bring it to you and they tell you about it and they want to know more. So it's really, it's every moment that you see just this excitement on their faces and just being out there. And when kids see you in the hall and they're like, I went to the garden, and they tell you about what they did. It's really exciting.
What would you say to other schools who might want to start this project or you know, have a garden for their students, but maybe, I don't know, maybe they're intimidated. Maybe they think it's too big of a lift.
Well, I think it's definitely start small. Our garden has evolved over many years into, you know, a different space. Every year I feel like we change it. So I think just knowing that a garden is important and getting kids outside is important, that start small and just start.
Ava, how can parents, students, community members get involved and learn more?
absolutely. If people are interested in volunteering or getting involved, they can contact their local school or district and see how they can get involved, or they can contact us at sullivan180.org. It's also part of a larger grant program. So our Catskill Edible Garden Project grants open for any schools, daycares, or youth-focused nonprofits on November 15th. So you can apply on the Sullivan 180 website.
And what's next for the Edible Garden Project? Any big plans?
Oh, yeah. We've got lots of plans. It's really just about getting kids the ability to go out into the gardens as often as and richly as we can. So we're really excited to continue that work at the schools that have gardens and then grow into new spaces as well.
That's Ava Bednar, Sullivan 180 Garden Coordinator, and Christy Green, Liberty Elementary School Garden Coordinator. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And we'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll find out why a local artist has installed two whimsical pink chairs floating over a busy corner of Manhattan. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at catskillspropertycare.com. And from The Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
The need is growing. More families in our community are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are on the front lines, but they need help. You can make a difference by donating non-perishable food, personal care items, and baby supplies, or by volunteering to support and distribute these donations. It's about nourishing our neighbors. Visit WJFFradio.org for info to help ensure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear some jazz heat, bongo beat, plus the Voodoo Five plays the Dead Kennedys.
Clouded future stings my eyes. I still find time to exercise.
I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7 here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Local multimedia artist Risha Gorig has placed a new presence on a busy Manhattan street corner. It's her public sculpture installation titled The Space Between Us, and it acts as a quiet foil to the roar of the city, she says. In conversation with culture reporter Valerie Manzi, Gorig explains how the piece becomes a metaphor for dialogue, connection, and reflection amid the urban rush. And as she looks beyond New York, she reveals that the work will soon find a home in the Catskills.
Today, my guest is Risha Gorig, and she is a Claryville resident as well as a resident of Brooklyn. She is an artist that does her work up here. It's a public art installation that is in New York City, and she's here to tell us about it. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Nice to talk to you guys.
So tell us a little bit about how you got into public art.
Well, I'm a multimedia artist, and I did paintings, and then I started making sculptures. And then I started making outdoor sculptures, which many times they were kinetic, using elements like the wind, the sun, water to propel my pieces or magnify an idea. And then I got making film, feature films. And now I kind of went full circle again, and I'm back to making public art and outdoor sculptures. And I like it a lot because people from all walks of life can interact with the sculptures in an outdoor setting. And I really like that about public work. It's like everybody can be exposed to it who are going to work, who are shopping.
Now, this particular piece of public art has quite a history. Can you tell us about it and tell us the name?
Sculpture that is in Manhattan now is called The Space Between Us. And initially, actually, it was installed the first time in Dumbo, Fulton Landing Park, right by the Brooklyn Bridge. And back then, it was meant to be about the division between Wall Street and the working class man. So one could see visually Brooklyn Bridge and Wall Street in the background and Brooklyn. And that's kind of how that piece was back then, though it always was about conversations, that we need to have conversations.
Well, describe the piece, how it relates to conversation and dialogue.
Well, it's two chairs that appear like they are floating in space. They are mounted on 17-foot poles with a base, and there's a distance between them. It's a metaphor about conversation and exchange that we need much today, or probably throughout history, but maybe even more so now. It just feels like everything's so polarized. And I have them floating up there because I wanted to have a feeling of vulnerability and fragility, and life is fragile.
Where in the city is this public art of yours?
It actually was initially at Union Square for a year. And then recently now it got moved in November to the Flatiron District on 22nd Street and Broadway.
Wow. So it's nice that various venues have been open to your work.
Yes, yes. It's wonderful. And it was a collaboration initially with New York City Parks and Union Square Partnership, and now it's with DOT, or Department of Transportation, and Flatiron Partnership. Yes, yes, I'm very fortunate, and I feel very lucky that they took my piece.
And there must be a lot that goes into public installation art.
Yes, it does take a lot. It has to be strong. It has to withstand certain wind speeds. And just making it, it's large scale. Like me and Joseph, we made the cement bases and put a lot of rebar in there. So it's quite intensive. Yeah.
And what are the chairs made of?
Initially, they actually were made out of wood. But now they are aluminum. So aluminum is strong, it's weather resistant.
And it looks like, from what I saw, that the chairs at first were like almost like a bentwood design?
Yes. Initially, they were more the traditional farm-style chairs, and now they're more rounded. They're more fragile looking now at Flatiron.
Oh, okay. And how do you get feedback about your work?
Oh, yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people send me pictures on Instagram, Facebook, sometimes emails, and people share their thoughts on it, and videos and pictures. It's quite amazing. I love it. It's almost like they become part of the whole process and conversation. And, you know, I think it is provoking a bit of conversation and questions when people walk by and see them floating up there. Like, I had a woman who came by and she was standing there. She said, "Are you the artist?" I said, "Yeah." She says, "Oh, I wish I would have seen this piece a year ago, as me and my husband just got divorced. And maybe if I showed him this piece, it could have talk more."
Wow. That's quite a response. Yes.
I know.
And you mentioned that your work may be coming up to the Catskills.
Yes. Yes. I'm in conversation with Benicia. It's supposed to be placed there in a few months.
Well, you'll be sure to let us know.
Definitely, 100%. I'm really, really, really excited about that, too. I'm glad that they're open to having the piece there.
Wonderful. Wonderful for you and wonderful for all of us in the Catskill. Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to add was I was just hoping this piece would be in many cities, in many places, as a symbol, a metaphor of exchange and dialogue and fragility.
And do you have a website that our folks can get to?
Yes, definitely. It's www.rishagoregart.
Okay, well, thank you, Risha, so much, and I can't wait to see it in Phoenicia.
Yes, thank you so much for also having me on your show, and thanks to everybody in the Catskills and Radio Catskills.
You are welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that report. Tomorrow on Radio Chatskill, Governor Kathy Hochul's administration is clearing a big roadblock for a natural gas pipeline off the state's coast near New York City. It was previously rejected. Tomorrow, Genevieve Hartnett has the details and reaction from environmental activists. That's tomorrow on Radio Chatskill. And before we go, again, it's Veterans Day. Several ceremonies have taken place and some just starting in a few minutes at 11, noting that the one in Bethel here nearby at 11 o'clock at Veterans Park on Route 55 in Conneaugh Lake features guest speaker, 100th District Assembly member Paula Kay. Then later in Liberty, starting at 5 until they're sold out, there's a spaghetti and meatball dinner at the Liberty Elks Lodge, number 1545, located on Darby Lane in Liberty, just down the road from us here. Our veterans eat free. And we want to thank all of our veterans for their service. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Bill Williams. Join me tonight for the Kingfisher Project. My guest will be Bridget Brennan of the New York City Special Narcotics Prosecutor's Office.
I think the most important thing that people should know is that the drug supply is very dangerous, that there's help available, and that all of us are working towards the same goal.
That's the Kingfisher Project, this evening at 6 on the Local Edition, only on Radio Catskill.
We believe nonpartisan, nonprofit news is essential to a healthy community. And as a Radio Catskill listener, we're guessing you feel the same way. We deliver fact-based journalism that holds the powerful accountable and keeps our community informed. Every story we produce is powered by listeners like you. And right now, through December 31st, your gift to Radio Catskill will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $1,000, by Newsmatch. Support local news and information. Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Well, that white stuff you see in the sky is snow, yes. We might see snow for at least the next hour or so. A heavier squall possible, accumulating to a coating of about an inch of snow. Cloudy, windy, colder today. Watch for sudden whiteouts and some slippery roads, high of only 32. Tonight, breezy, a flurry possible later on, low 25. Tomorrow, a little bit warmer, but we'll see a mix of rain and snow showers, high 37. And then Thursday, partly sunny, breezy, high of 41. On Point is coming up next.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. We meet a family that was recently deported to Honduras, despite having legal protections to remain in the U.S. We learn how their story is now part of a broader legal effort to return families like theirs, who should be protected under a legal settlement with the U.S. government. That's this week on Latino USA. Thursday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180,
building healthy communities through people, places, and policy, one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org and from listeners like you.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.